Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing foreign governments negotiated peace settlement, peace agreement, looking at the Qatari government's negotiated ceasefire between DRC Congo and Rwanda. I'm joined by an important guest, Dr. Jonathan Beloff. Dr. Jonathan Beloff is a postdoctoral researcher at King's College London. Jonathan is a researcher on the Great Lakes region, particularly Rwanda's politics, foreign relations, and security. His research focuses on countries in the Great Lakes region, including Burundi, Tanzania, Kenya, Central African Republic, and of course, DRC. Jonathan, it's a great pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, brilliant. So let's start off. So in, I think, last month, we had a surprise meeting in Doha between the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, and President Felix Tshisekedi of DRC. That was initiated by the Emir by the Qatar Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad. That was quite surprising, considering that the previous efforts in the continent or in the region, you know, didn't yield much. Can you tell us how this, the importance of this meeting and how this meeting came about, and the impact or importance of this meeting?
Thank you again for having me on. We are seeing a rise in non-traditional powers playing a greater role in African conflicts and in African politics. Typically, we would often, if negotiations didn't happen on the continent, it would be somewhere in Western Europe, or it would be in the United States, Canada, or even during the Cold War, it would maybe be in Russia or China, the Soviet Union or China. But things are dramatically shifting, and it's been going on for the last few years, maybe for the decade, that you're having different players, especially from the Middle East. We have Qatar, Turkey, the UAE trying to play bigger roles, whether it is the conflict in Congo, which we're talking about now, or the situation at the Horn of Africa, or North Sudan, or etc. That we are having these different countries getting involved. And in particular with Qatar. Qatar has a very close relationship with Rwanda. It owns just under half of Rwanda Air, Rwanda's primary airlines, as well as providing a lot of money for infrastructure projects in Rwanda, especially the new international airport. Additionally, it has relations with the DRC with the mineral trade. Whether conflict minerals or non-conflict minerals, a lot of times when they depart from the Democratic Republic of Congo, they often are going into the Middle East, where even the conflict minerals get cleaned up a little bit to be sold in the international markets. So there has been this drive by some Middle Eastern powers, the ones I mentioned before, to get more involved. While some of it deals with economics, another deals with for these countries to increase their soft power politics, not just in the region, but globally. Qatar, over the last 20, 30 years, have tried to position itself as a mediator. While we typically see this in terms of the Middle East, especially with the Israeli Hamas war, with Qatar being a supporter of Hamas, They are also trying to have that title for other conflicts that are going around, whether it deals with Syria, with the new regime, or now, as we see in Africa. The meeting between the Rwanda and Congolese president in Qatar not too long ago was a bit of a surprise in terms of how it seemed to have come out of nowhere. And what I've also heard is that this was not months in planning, but relatively days or weeks before it actually happened, where the Qataris wanted to bring the two big leaders of the conflict, but not the only leaders of the conflict, to Qatar to try to hash out a negotiation, to try to come up with some form of whether ceasefire or some stability or just some outcome that will at least decrease the violence in the present moment.
Brilliant. You've mentioned something very, very key, and that is we're seeing right now like a shift in global geopolitics. We're beginning to see, whereas in the past, after the post-COVID, we had a clear hegemon. Now we don't have that. We see, like Riley mentioned, we see middle powers like Turkey, like you mentioned. Recently, we saw Turkey negotiated the peace agreement between Somalia and Ethiopia. So we see them playing all of these big role. Now, how do you see that in terms of the receding influence of traditional partners, like I'll say mainly Western nations in this region? How do you see that in the medium to long term? Does that have any? Again, if you look at it against the background of Trump's protectionism policies and all of that, what do you see? What's the implication? We'll come back to Congo, but if you look at more geopolitics, what implication does that have to the West?
So there had always been kind of waves of perceptions when it comes to the global North, comes to the West, positive and very negative, since the end of colonization. But in particular, from like 45 until 1990, Africa was able to play off the West with the East, with the Soviet Union and China, for more favorable terms. Going back to, this is how Joseph Mobutu, the president of Zaire, now the DRC, was able to remain in power for so long. But when the Cold War ended, you had kind of this unofficial norm that, okay, capitalism, the West has won. And U.S., we were a unipolar world in the 90s and early 2000s, where the U.S. was the supreme, where every country wanted to develop closer ties with the United States. We look at Ethiopia, we look at Rwanda, we look at Uganda, we look even with Laurent Kabila, who came to take over the Congo after the first Congo War. This new generation of African leaders was taught, this term was came from U.S. President Bill Clinton. But with the U.S. war on terrorism, with shifting strategic goals for the West when it came to Africa, more focusing in the 2000s on the war on terrorism, less on democracy, state building, etc., or less in the old what was being promoted in the 90s to more of a pragmatism, a neorealism, which has at times been beneficial and not. And especially we look at what happened in West Africa, and then a lot of the Sahel with the coups that happened. A lot of it was a response to the French inabilities with their military campaigns, Operation Barkhane, if I believe. Thank you. In defeating terrorist organizations, this kind of distrust of the West with the conditionality of aid, as well as hypocrisy that we had seen growing in terms of social movements, in terms of with the LGBT that the U.S. under Joe Biden was really promoting in the State Department, having the LGBT flag being flown at U.S. embassies, which was seen as kind of disrespectful to the social norms of some African countries. Then we have the rise of Donald Trump 2.0, which has taken a departure from his first administration, kind of depicting this, I won't say we're isolationists or he's an isolationist, but this very American first policy Well, we saw elements of this, in particular in Rwanda, where with the used clothing markets, about how the U.S., you know, was pushing the Rwanda government to accept, without tariffs, without issues, used clothing from the United States, where Rwanda pushed back. This was in the late 2010s, but now this seems to be the policy of Donald Trump, of U.S. interests first, which for a lot of African countries, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. One, the language that past presidents have given, that the West has often given about human rights, about democracy, about et cetera, but was always kind of known to be a little hollow when it came to then state interests in Africa, these countries' interests. They'll push those to the side when it serves as convenience. So there was some with Donald Trump and the U.S. like, okay, we'll go and get a president who's actually going to tell us what he thinks, what he feels. He's not going to use this over this language of democracy and liberalism, when in the end he's going to still be a neorealistic president promoting U.S. interests over others. However, for the continent, they're experiencing what I think a lot of the world is experiencing, just the unknown of what's going to come out of Washington, D.C. Having these tariffs is also very questionable when you look at the sizes or the strengths of these economies that we're comparing. Nigeria compared to the U.S., Nigeria, South Africa, Egypt, some of the strongest economies in Africa, but yet they pale in comparison to the U.S. So, and it brings up the question of, like, why is Nigeria or Congo that much of an economic threat to the U.S. that we require tariffs? So for the African continent, for a lot of governments, I could completely understand why they're like, you know, U.S. is still extremely important. They are the strongest country in the world in terms of military, economics, et cetera, et cetera. But yet we might need to diversify our relations. And we don't necessarily want to go back to Western Europe because we don't know what they're going to do, whether we can trust them or not, whether they're going to be actually good or effective, because the French weren't. So that's why looking not just towards China or Russia, but also looking at these Middle Eastern powers, like middle powers like Qatar and Turkey.
You mentioned something very poignant, which is true. Like, even during the Cold War, African had agency. They had leverage. They were able to play off the Soviet Union against this. But again, we're seeing more because we had one minister from DRC on the podcast, and she mentioned China's dominance when it comes to mineral in DRC, and how the U.S. is trying to, you know, not necessarily catch up, but to regain that stuff. And then again, we're seeing with DRC, with what you're saying, with all these diversified partners or hosts. But then again, we see with President Tshisekedi, how he's also looking to curry favor from the Trump administration in terms of the mineral deal. We've just had an episode that we've not really aired, but we've just done looking at how that. Do you think this is that African agency or leverage or power as well to play off these for its own benefit?
It's very difficult to say because the rumors came out, I forgot how many weeks ago, that that the Congolese wanted to negotiate with Donald Trump. It seemed like they looked at the situation in Ukraine and how the Trump administration wants a mineral deal there to deal with the whole war with Russia. And it felt a bit like the Congolese government, Kinshasa, was just like, oh, maybe we could do something similar to curry favor. I have no idea how true these rumors are. I have no doubt, though, that someone probably would be thinking about that. It's like, well, if Trump, you know, if to get on Trump's good side, we just have to, you know, sign off our minerals. It's not the first time we've done that with the United States or with Belgium or France or China now. Is this the possibility with agency to regain some agency? I don't entirely know. Because during the Cold War, the West had that existential threat of the Soviet Union and of Marxism, communism. And that was much more of a driver in the U.S. involvement, of Western Europe's involvement in Africa than what I think we have now. We kind of still have the absence of that. And the threat of China, especially in Washington, D.C., you'll hear that rhetoric. I'm not entirely believer in it. I believe, you know, competition is competition in the end. The poor practices of the Chinese, you got to look at, you know, in the continent, the African leadership that allows those things to happen, rather than just blame the Chinese. So I think it is kind of difficult. It is an avenue. It is a possible pathway for some of these African countries to try to reclaim some agency when it comes to the West, saying, well, if you don't want to give us X, Y, Z in this mineral deal or whatever deal, we can look elsewhere. However, I don't think the West is aware enough of the situation in Africa, thinking that the past policies, the past methods will still work today when they are radically out of date. So it could be beneficial with Africa, but as well as, you know, there's still a lot of pitfalls because we don't entirely know what's coming out of Washington.
There's something you mentioned, which I agree with. I've been in meetings where, in my own opinion, which I share with you, I think is exaggerated, this threat of China. We were in a meeting where they were looking at military bases in Africa. And the military bases, Chinese military bases in Africa, pales compared to the West, and they were looking at that. But then again, if you look at Qatar, back to Qatar, look at its economic influence in both countries, and how that undeniably played the role in how fast they were able to bring these two leaders into bring them together to have a talk. Now, if I link that to maybe China as well, look at China's non-interference approach, look at Russia's and all of this stuff, because a whole lot of stuff that Africans usually would say is these people didn't colonize Africa and the case. But then, do you think in the long run, looking at that level of investment, Chinese investment, you know, it looks like there's no conditionality. Do you think in the long run, the depth that is, it could be adverse to Africa?
Very much so. The claim that I do hear, like, oh, China never colonized, Russia never colonized, it's completely ignoring their internal history. Russia colonized Siberia and basically two-thirds of the country, what is now Russia, with China, with Tibet, and in Western China. You know, there's not too many clean people in history. They're providing something that, especially China, that the West hadn't been doing as much of, the promise of building infrastructure, physical infrastructure. I remember, I think this was in Uganda, it could have been Rwanda, I apologize, in a village when I was talking to people about this, and like, yes, the US has helped when it comes to with schools. But how are our kids going to actually get to that school? There's no road. The Chinese are at least willing to build the road. That's how we'll build the economy. That's what the West did to build their economy, what China did. But to say like, oh, it's kind of free money, or it's like, oh, there's no strings attached with Chinese money, is very problematic. As we see with one of the big geopolitical strategic goals of the Chinese, the String of Pearls, which is basically creating a trade route in the Pacific Ocean, the South China Sea, where the Chinese government has been giving huge loans and been physically building a lot of times ports, airports, other infrastructures to help support this String of Pearls, which its goal is to help build the Chinese economy, help with its exports, making transport costs much cheaper for the Chinese goods, thus making them more attractive in the markets. And we've seen, like in Sri Lanka, in Pakistan, that if you fall behind in the payments, if you recognize or you engage with Taiwan, the Chinese government will press back very hard. Well, they will, I believe it's Sri Lanka, could be Pakistan, an airport that they built. The government kind of couldn't afford, the local government couldn't afford the interest payments or just the payments from the loans. And the Chinese government literally took the airport, sent in security forces and say, well, until this is paid back, this is ours. You know, we paid for this. We built it mostly without labor. So this is ours. So I think that's very important. While we haven't seen as much of that in Africa yet, I think that it's the word yet is very important, that it can lead back to that. China is doing things for their own strategic interests. They are not doing it because they have hearts filled with love. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, following state interests. But African states need to realize and need to also, this is part, you know, responsibility is part of agency. It's the consequences that they have to be very smart in their engagements with China and making sure that they are not, they don't become indebted to China as they have been to, for instance, the World Bank during the structural agreement programs in the 80s and the chaos that that caused.
You and I kind of share, it's surprising, you and I share a lot of there's no altruistic intervention, there's there's no charitable stuff. And I've always said, what I've always said is, like in my current research that I'm writing, is what the West I think did is to give that impression that, you know, AIDS is right, and say, okay, we've got this interest, and the Africans should be able to say, there should be some kind of balancing of interest, alignment of interest. But there's no, at least there's nothing wrong, like I always say, in having interest. But if we come to, so let's go back a little bit in history and go to, because I want to link that into African solutions for African problem, the role of the African, you know, all of that. So if we go back to shortly before the Rwandan genocide, so we had the Arusha Accord that was, you know, negotiated in Africa, and that agreement wasn't really respected, that led to partly led to the genocide. So from there till now, there seems to be less trust on the African negotiated solutions compared to externalized, you know, negotiations. I don't know if you
during the 93 Arusha Accords, the Rwandan government at the time, the Habyarimana regime, they were heavily utilizing Belgian negotiators during it. I've spoken to RPF as well as RPF negotiators, as well as people who attended. And this was a common theme that I found. Also, Linda Melvitt and Andrew Wallace writes about this, that, you know, the Belgians and French were heavily involved on the side of the Rwandan government. But it is this weird dichotomy that we have here, that the global North is really pushing, that this idea that African solutions for African problems, that this is the way to really solve African conflicts. But yet, they don't entirely know their role in this mechanism. Okay, what does the West actually do in this case? Do we help provide the infrastructure and then let the negotiators negotiate? Do we get involved? Do we become a moderator? Or do we basically keep on doing what we've done before? We're still involved in the negotiations. You've had, I feel, that last part a lot, that the Global North hasn't said, okay, we're going to take a step back and allow African countries to handle their own issues, their own problems. We still want to get involved, whether because of strategic interests or you have individuals or groups or NGOs who are interested in the humanitarian for either altruistic or usually for other reasons. Like, for instance, all the movements with the Lord's Resistance Army, Kony 2012, and etc. While there are altruistic elements, there's also financial and business elements there. So this is the problem that the continent has, is there is this goal for agency and for trying to solve their own conflicts. But yet it's very difficult for them to be able to separate from the West until the West agrees to separate itself. And maybe this is a reason why we are seeing these non-traditional allies, these middle powers stepping in, because African countries are like, okay, and actors, like, okay, they're providing us more what we want in terms for the negotiation than what the West is providing.
Very interesting. I'll come back to that in a minute. One similarity between the Arusha Accords and the current conflict in Eastern DRC is when we look at the M23 and look at Rwanda's position, saying, you know, there was an agreement, still on agreement, there's an agreement in 2012, I think, where the DRC government is supposed to, which is where they got the M23 name for, you know, to come and integrate some of these people into the military or something like that. But also in the Arusha Accord, there was a question of the transitional government where there was supposed to be like 40% RPF joining the military and stuff like that. Can you look at that? Can you talk about that similarity in because Kagame said that DRC needs to talk with M23. Yeah. They need to be on the table. So can you look at that similarity?
There's the differences might outnumber the similarities. So to provide some background with the M23, the March 23rd movement, which is named after the date of the peace agreement that was signed between the Congolese government in 2007 or 8 and a rebel force, CNDP, which, because members of that former rebel group that was supposed to integrate into the Congolese military in this DDR movement, the demilitarization, demobilization, and
reintegration.
Thank you. They feel like that agreement wasn't honored, and that's why the creation of the M23 in the early 2010s, and then its rebirth in just a few years ago, where in Rwanda you didn't have the same mechanisms, as well as with Rwanda you had mostly two actors. You had the Rwandan government at the time, and you had the Rwandan Patriotic Front. Both were much more organized, much more had much more institutional structures and powers than what we're having now in Congo. Because the situation in Congo is this, and there have been multiple peace agreements between what is now the M23 and its former incarnations to the Congolese government. But the problem is in Congo, unlike you had in Rwanda, is in Congo, how many rebel groups are there? How many secession movements are there? How many of the smaller, the Mai Mai, are there? And as well as just the size of the country, Congo is, what, over 50 times bigger than Rwanda. Yeah. It's a massive country. Yeah. A complete creation of colonization. And with one person who could have possibly brought the country together being killed by the Belgians, not, you know, soon after independence. It's very difficult of how do you not just have a peace agreement that actually fosters peace in the Congo, or let alone in the East, or let alone North Kivu, because there are so many different actors that they have to negotiate with. There's roughly like 40 to 50 major rebel groups in the Congo, and 100 smaller ones, the Mai Mai. Like, how do you negotiate with that compared to in 93 in Rwanda, where it was predominantly just two main actors?
RPF, yeah.
But it's something one of the big similarities is how do you enforce it? Because neither have been enforced. The Arusha Accords were signed in August 1993, and by the night of April 6, 1994, the genocide begins. And while Tutsis are being targeted and being killed, the first week of the genocide, you have a coup that happens. You have the Hutu extremists who are getting rid of any moderate members who are part of the Arusha government that came after August 1993. They're getting targeted, they're getting killed, or given the choice. You either join the genocide regime that we're creating, or you're going to be killed, with most being killed. Thus, after the first week of the genocide, you have this new government, which is its strategic goal is to kill as many Tutsis as possible. The failures of the international community, especially UNAMIR, is well known. Really, UNAMIR was saved by the Rwandan Patriotic Front. When you actually look at the military history, what was going on in the first few weeks, literally the RPA had to provide safe zones 2 days into the genocide for UNAMIR's headquarters in the eastern part of the city. And you have the same thing in Congo, where the multiple peace agreements, ceasefire agreements, transitional agreements, no one is enforcing it. No one can enforce it. MINUSCO, which has been the biggest peacekeeping force, I believe, of all time, 20,000 soldiers, $1 billion being spent at least a year, that has not been able to really enforce any peace agreements.
Yeah, but we've had several episodes here where we've had and some of our guests have compared, whereas one of them have been like a stark comparison of the 90s compared to say there's no peace to enforce.
Yeah.
Because there's that rather than focus on you rightly, there's a way you captioned it. So what we've seen right now is rather than focus on you know some of like lasting peace, we're looking at new you know pragmatism, stabilization policies, and all this kind of like policies, and there's no peace to enforce. But then again, when we talk about enforcing peace, again, looking at the vacuum that has been created or the kind of like confusion in terms of which actor or which, you know, is it the America, is it the EU, is it NATO, who is going to enforce this? Where's the moral? Again, look at the moral, do they have that moral standing to be able to enforce this? And then again, if you look at that and tie that into Qatar, look at the immediate ceasefire. In line with this, do you think that is achievable, the ceasefire, and has it even been adhered to?
So the question really should be, what do we see as the end goal here? I think what's been very problematic since World War II has been and I can speak for the United States being growing up in the US, the separation between civilians and military, even after the September 11th attacks with the war on terrorism, we all became extremely patriotic and always supporting the military, but we actually don't really know how a military operates. And based off some leaks that are coming out from the Pentagon yesterday and today, probably that feeling is in the military itself, in the Pentagon, in Washington at least. But since World War II, we've had this notion, and I think for altruistic reasons, we don't want to see human suffering. We don't want to see chaos. We don't want to see death, rape, and et cetera. However, we've kind of misunderstood the concepts of war as very short-term bursts. The situation, you can have a ceasefire now, but the war doesn't end. Well, the most, you know, we have the example of like the Korean ceasefire, that there was an armistice signed in 1953, but the two countries, North and South Korea, are technically still at war. There's been a cold peace there, but that's very hard. I don't think that's been replicated really anywhere else. Ceasefires only temporarily pause things, but it doesn't necessarily fix the situation. And the goal of a ceasefire a lot of times is then to set up the mechanisms for there to be a long-term peace. But this is very difficult to achieve, especially when there isn't a military victory. As I wrote a few months ago for Military Strategic Magazine, is the M23 successes is really rooted down to military strategic theory. They have a clear end goal. They have a clear ways and means, and they know who they're fighting, what they're fighting for, with relatively good leadership. The ones who fled in the mid 2010s, M23's leadership fled to Uganda and Rwanda. A lot of the ones who fled to Rwanda are still in Rwanda under heavy watch, while the ones in Uganda restarted the movement a few years ago. But with the Congolese military's inability to stop the M23, you have SADC's relative inability to stop it. There isn't a position of strength for the Congolese government to really negotiate, as well as the M23 is well aware of this, that they have the upper hand. And we have this misunderstanding of asymmetry in warfare, that because the M23 are rebels, they're not necessarily weaker than the Congolese military. They've shown the complete opposite. And while a lot of people want to look at Rwanda for that, if you get rid of Rwanda tomorrow, the M23 doesn't disappear. Rwanda, their history in Eastern Congo seems to provide, seems to extend to explain the M23, whether that's accurate or not, whether the assumptions made there or not. So while you have a lot who want to get involved in creating a ceasefire, because once again, it illustrates soft power and it's a good PR move, and especially the Qataris need it right now, I think more than ever before. However, having a ceasefire only pauses the conflict. The conflict needs to properly end. Negotiated peace settlements haven't, unfortunately, been that end, as we constantly see, not just with the M23, but with so many other the rebel groups. That I think that needs to be the focus, that if we have a ceasefire, who enforces it in Congo, in such a massive area? The Kivu, so Eastern Congo, is the size of like a third the size of Western Europe. That's massive, and not too many countries want to get involved in that. And you send in 20,000 peacekeepers, and they still were basically ineffective, or even worse, they helped keep the status quo that gave rebel groups the ability to rearm, reorganize, and then re-engage.
It's very, very key. So when we talk about how conflict ends, you in the literature, you look at when you have quick military victory, it could end in that way, when one party. But people have said, like what we see in Sudan, where the RSF and the Sudanese army have relative kind of like power, and how that has protracted the conflict. And then again, you look at how interventions like this can also protract of the conflict. Now, if you tie that into what we said about Congo, how big it is, and look at again the dynamic or complex dynamic of the eastern region, like look at Congo itself and how it is tied, the border region to Burundi, to Uganda, and all of these countries are tied into that conflict or that eastern. How do you see? It seems to be very, like I agree, it seems very, very complex. It's a very, very complex conflict with different vested interests from all of these neighboring countries. So is it going to require, some people have also argued that the DRC government is absent in Eastern DRC. That is quite big, it's just at the center. And some have also, I think, moved about maybe seeding or some of those godlike, and I'm thinking of what Trump administration is saying about ceding Crimea to Russia. Oh, do you see any of this happening in the Congo?
No, I don't think Congo will give away Crimea to Russia. So a lot of people, when they talk about the Congo Wars, this is Africa's world war. This is the continental wars. However, I think that's because of the amount of neighbors who were involved, like a dozen or so. But that's always, I've always had problems with that, because there's always been the hard borders that were designed by the colonials, by the colonial powers, and then agreed upon after African independence. Mm-hmm. There's always been involvement in each other's countries, because these hard borders are very porous. And how especially these borders were created ignores the realities that are on the ground. Look at Ethiopia and Somalia with the Ogaden, the massive Somali population in the east. So the regional powers play a massive role, because the situation in Congo just doesn't affect the Congolese. It affects other people too. I had one time the former chief of staff for the Rwandan military, General Patrick Nirumba, say this to me when I asked him, why is Rwanda sending peacekeepers to the Central Africa Republic? This is, I think, 2014. When it's, you know, over 1,000 kilometers away, it has Rwanda has little strategic interest in the country, et cetera, et cetera. And he responded saying, when a neighbor's house catches on fire, you don't ignore it. You go and help it. Not just because you're helping your neighbor, but because you know that fire can eventually, if left untreated, will reach your house. So that is why we also participate in peacekeeping, is because we don't want these conflicts that are around to eventually come and burn in Rwanda, with the obvious question about, yeah, but then what about the Congo situation? That's literally your biggest neighbor, neighbor right now. But I do think, and as we are kind of seeing when it comes to a lot of these African countries in the region, whether SADC or the EAC, the East African Community, them putting pressure on Kinshasa. You have Angola, especially, who is somewhat of a guarantor of the Congolese government, you know, saying to the president, you need to sit down with the M23. Just blaming Rwanda isn't going to help anything. And you've had President Felix try to engage with African countries to side with him, like Chad. But for the most part, a lot of countries are saying, you know, enough with, you know, looking at Rwanda, whether they're responsible or not is irrelevant. This is an internal situation. You have to deal with the Banyarwanda, the main ethnic group, which the M23 composes of. Like, you have to deal with them differently, because their problems, with a lot of them legitimate, or led to this rebel group. That is why Tanzania, unlike 10 years ago, which they sent in troops in the Foreign Intervention Brigade that was designed to fight the M23, they don't have the same president who is looking at Rwanda. Kenyatta is no longer there. The Tanzanian government has been relatively mute in saying, you got to negotiate with the M23. And I think some of this has to deal with, as well as, Rwanda was very smart last year. President Kagame did a very interesting power move. That's not the best word, but he reorganized the decks a bit. And he moved as his minister of state, especially for the African Great Lakes, General James Kabarere, the guy who led the first Congo War, who was heavily involved in the second, the guy who probably knows more about the Congo than most Congolese, at least more than anyone else outside of Africa. He became the minister of state who became in the foreign ministry, who was responsible of talking to African countries and saying, this is the Rwanda position. This is our evidence to show why we aren't involved, as the UN is accusing. And I think that's been very effective for Rwanda, is having this guy, this extremely knowledgeable guy, who is also very, very reserved, leading their side of the argument, which Congo has not been able to do. And that's why a lot of the regional powers are saying to Kinshasa, negotiate with the M23. And that was something that that Kagame, even Qatar, after the meeting, said that Kinshasa really needs to talk to the people in the East. And now with Joseph Kabila in Goma,
that's
now even more interesting. And exactly what he's going to do, we'll find out in the days and weeks ahead.
Okay. Speaking, you've already started touching on the last question I was going to ask you. So I think we'll just focus on that and say, how do you see this conflict moving forward? In terms of what's going to happen in the short to the long term, who are going to be the actors to either bring peace or escalate, or what is it? If you,
I feel like if I knew what the future held, I'd be a very rich man. Right now. Whenever someone asks me that question, like, what's going to happen? That's always my response, because I have no idea. In a sense, like, pragmatically, yes. I feel, you know, history in the Congo rhymes. It repeats so often. I wrote a journal article about the M23 in the early to mid-2010s, and I reread it when the M23 came back. And I just realized, okay, some of the names have changed, but pretty much everything else is the same. The M23, though, has professionalized a lot more than they did in the first incarnation in terms of governance. How they're handling cities that they conquer is radically different than before. The amount of human rights abuses has dropped. They're trying to differentiate themselves from Kinshasa, from a city that a lot of people in the East feel don't really care about them for governance, for corruption, for economic opportunities. Kinshasa is interested in Kinshasa and not in the East. So, you know, at one level, I just want to say, like, the M23, right now, their goals, the strategic ends, which is very important, has been consistent of, we want to capture the Kivus, some other areas in the East to protect the Banyarwanda, to protect other groups as well who have been targeted by antagonistic forces such as the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, the FDLR, which is a Hutu ideological successor of the genocide regime in Rwanda. We also want to protect them from the Congolese military, which doesn't have the best track record as well. While their goals have been mostly focused on the East, they do mention once in a while, okay, maybe regime change in Kinshasa. But when we compare that to past Congolese rebel groups, it's not the same focus as we've seen with the M23. While there is the talks, and who knows, with Joseph Kabila, who was the enemy of the M23, those two hated each other, and now they're together. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Who knows if those strategic ends will change, if, hey, maybe they will make a march to Kinshasa. How much support do they have in the Katanga region? That could also be very beneficial. I don't entirely know what the future is going to hold with this region. I would love for, you know, ideally for the war to end, for there to be a, you know, it's terrible. And, but I think it's now a necessity. The cycle needs to end. The cycle of violence needs to end. How does it end? The attempts through negotiation, through DDR, through political transition haven't really worked. There needs to be some centralized military force that's able to bring security for Congo, for the Congolese people, for their economy, and et cetera, et cetera. And I don't see that anywhere right now. But at a pragmatic level, the conflict isn't going anywhere. In the short term, even in the long term, even if there is a ceasefire that lasts for a few years, maybe in 10 years, we'll get another group. Like, who are the incarnations of the M23, who are the incarnations of what they were in the early 2010s, who is an incarnation of CNDP, who is an incarnate, like, you just have these new generations with the same problems, same issues. And until those are actually properly addressed, but the only way that could be addressed is if the war is over, if someone wins the war, brings security, stability to Congo, thus an economy can grow, thus people can get jobs, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I hear in the optimism. We have to stay on the path. On the path of this, and hope that there's going to be blah blah. Like Riley said, it's so sad that same issues and these things keep repeating itself. Whether it's been 10 years after, you know, after M23 took over Goma in 2012, you know, 10 years after, it could be another 10 years. So we need to look at long-term solutions and deal with the root causes. Yeah. I do agree with you. But yes, thank you very much for your very rich insights. And really appreciate you coming on the...
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, Jonathan. Yeah, enjoy the rest
of your day. Thank you again.
Yeah, you too. Bye. Thank you for tuning in to this week's exciting episode, where we've dealt with the Qatari's negotiated settlement peace agreement between the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, and the president of the DRC, President Félix Tshisekedi, in the ongoing war in Eastern DRC. As you join me to thank our guest, Dr. Jonathan Beloff, and stay blessed till we see you again.